I just want to be careful with language. We will continue to rely on data and facts that we're collecting, create some kind of special sauce. I can tell you, you know, I understand that they are in tears.
And when I talk to people, I can tell you, you know, I understand that they are in tears. I understand that they are in tears.
Gay shame is a virus in the system. We are committed to a trans queer extravaganza that brings direct action to spectacular levels of confrontation. We work collectively outside boring and deceptive nonprofit models to fight white supremacy, capitalism, ableism, cops, settler colonialism, and all forms of domination. Liberals think we are frivolous decorations and mainstream gays want us gone. Against them and with each other, we instigate, irritate, and agitate to build cultures of devastating resistance. And this is our fourth or fifth podcast.
I am Mary Howard Johnson.
And I'm Mary Daggers.
And I'm Mary Crisis.
And this is Mary Prance. And today we're going to talk specifically about the shelter-in-place hotels. If people don't know, San Francisco to respond to how the COVID-19 coronavirus pandemic was impacting its unhoused folks decided to put folks inside of hotels. And so we're just going to have a little discussion about that tonight.
San Francisco, one of the big industries, is tourism. And because of COVID-19, obviously, there are no tourists coming to get on the trolley. In fact, the trolley was not running. As a result, we had all these empty hotel rooms and still tons and tons of people on the street.
And within Gay Shame, some of us have been homeless, some of us have squatted, some of us are precariously housed. Really, who isn't right now?
Shelter in Place, aka SIP, hotels were formed. We've had a long-standing problem of houseless people not having a place to go. Prior to the pandemic, the wait list for shelter beds was always at least 1,000 people over the number of shelter beds available. And it's principally San Franciscans who are getting evicted. Shelters have their own problems. We won't get into that in this episode. But the SIP hotels were created as a temporary place where people could go during what was assumed to be a short-lived pandemic. And it's just been a great big politically constructed mess ever since March of 2020. Currently, there are 2,300 people in hotels, and all of these people have been promised some sort of support upon getting out, which we can give you a little bit more info on that later when we speak with our guest, a fellow Mary.
Mary Crisis, who has been working at one of the SIP hotels.
We're trying to be critical of the shelter-in-place hotels and talk about what we would like to see, but how much we, like, don't want to be in alignment with, like, right-wing efforts to shut down the hotels.
Yes.
And that we're, like, holding all of that complexity. Like, that's what our aim is to be able to talk critically about it, while also, you know, always keeping in mind that we want people to have housing. We want, like, those, like, promises that San Francisco is supposedly making to come true.
For people who are not aware, in San Francisco, we are living off of some, like, storied reputation that is not exactly based in reality. Yes, there are a few moments in San Francisco history. For example, there was a fight over the iHotel. iHotel was in what was Manila Town, mainly Filipinx neighborhood, that was torn down by developers with the help of the city, where low-income people lived, and there was a huge movement that formed around it.
But in general, the real estate industry rules, and so...
Gay Shame has been, for at least the last 10 years, a lot of our focus has been around gentrification issues, because gentrification issues are an issue that affects not just queer people, although queer and trans people, especially of color, and low-income people, and people with disabilities are the people who are targeted the most by this pro-real estate regime that we exist in here in San Francisco. Most of our local politicians are funded by the real estate industry. One of the departments that seems to be immune from budget cuts is the Department of Public Works, DPW, which, along with the cops, are the ones to basically go around. Their job is to harass homeless people, throw away their tents, throw away their medication, throw away their assistive devices for accessibility, and basically move them around in a circle. Try to disappear them, try to make their existences as illegal as possible with local ordinances like sit-lie, which makes it a finable offense to sit or lie on the sidewalk anywhere, even if you are not doing a damn thing to bother anyone. They've taken many of the park benches out of areas under the express intention to get rid of homeless people, especially the wealthier and the very tourist-facing areas like the Castro, Union Square, San Francisco, like everywhere else, has been super anti-Black. We are down to, some people say 3, some people say 5% of the population is Black here in San Francisco, down from a high of 20% a couple decades back. And that's a very intentional removal of places where Black people lived, including famously the Fillmore District, which James Baldwin called...
Back in 1963.
On the drive into San Francisco, Baldwin began talking about the increasing bitterness, demoralization, and despair of Negro youths in northern cities.
Yeah, make you feel bad. Won't be no place to go. We'd be living out here on streets and tents.
Where would you like to go if you could? What part of San Francisco would you like to go?
I'd stay up here on top of the hill.
You would? How long have you been living on top of the hill?
Ever since I've been born.
And then this is part of my redevelopment also.
What do you mean? You say redevelopment, meaning
even the removal of Negroes.
Yes. That's
in other words, a lot of the Negroes who came because the Japanese were pushed out now are being pushed out themselves. That's right.
And in fact, San Francisco is reclaiming this,
that's right,
this property,
that's right,
to build it up, which means Negroes have to go.
That's right. And in,
where are they going to go?
Well, they're going out to Hunters Point and to the Haight-Ashbury area and also into Ocean View, and wherever they can find reasonable rents.
Yeah.
South of Market and all these other places, wherever they can find cheap rent. In other words, going from one ghetto to the other.
Yes, yes.
There is no moral distance. No moral distance, which is to say no distance, between the facts of life in San Francisco and the facts of life in Birmingham.
And so, you know, people of color who are low income exist in very small pockets of the city. They are way more likely to be houseless and or get cited to the point where they are put in jail. And so you have possibly 3% of the population of San Francisco is Black, but approaching half of our jail population is Black. The latest tech boom did not do anything positive. Our eviction court was the last court in town to close. It closed weeks after the other courts were closed. A few of us have been to eviction court proceedings. They're pretty disgusting displays. Chummy eviction lawyers chumming around with eviction court judges. Our local 311 line, the non-emergency 911, basically, is buzzing, especially post-COVID, with people having nothing to do, looking out their window, checking next door, and Citizen or whatever these other apps are, to report that they may have seen a dangerous houseless person out the window. And in reality, I think that the people on this call would agree that the real danger is coming from those motherfucking people who are using 311, got it on speed dial, got the app, got the website bookmarked, and are basically just terrorizing houseless people any chance they can get. There's a rock in the Castro that makes it impossible to sleep under an alcove, like if it's raining. They painted it in the colors of the rainbow flag for pride.
Back in 2019.
Rainbow Rock is in an alcove of Izakaya Sushi Ron in San Francisco's Castro District. Apparently, the Coalition on Homelessness shared this picture along with this message, which says, when you want to look inclusive but hate homeless people, I mean, are you fine with it? Is this hating on the homeless? We should point out that this restaurant owner actually had painted it gold, you know, before. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think it's more so a work of art.
Yeah, I mean, and they're also saying that they are providing a safe space mm-hmm. for people who may be homeless at a different door of the restaurant mm-hmm. where they can, if they want to, at night, sleep there. And they say this is part of like a peace garden, like a Zen garden.
Yeah.
And I've passed by this place a number of times on Market Street.
Me too.
And I wondered what the rock was for because, you know, to be fair, there are some businesses that put out, not necessarily rocks, but some kind of object to prevent homeless people from sleeping there at night. So I can understand the confusion.
But it's not like stakes, you know, like pigeons when they're on top of a building. Those, you know, anti-deterrent for birds.
Yeah.
I mean, who knows? Maybe for Halloween, it'll become a pumpkin. It'll change.
Pretty disgusting, considering queer youth tend to be very overrepresented among the homeless population. And this is in the context of houses going for $1 or $2 million.
In the context of this, like, aggression, like this policy aggression against homeless people, all of it is under the auspices of helping. Like it's always this paternalistic narrative around helping people who, like, everyone knows are more vulnerable to being impacted by violence, and are more marginalized. And so there's this really, like, this split where this, like, anti-homeless policy is happening at the same time as it's always, like, for their own good. Supposedly,
safety is a word they keep dropping in, like, we're doing it for their safety.
Right. And, like, never factoring in, like, houseless people being able to organize and represent themselves, like people from Poor Magazine, like Street Sheet, all of these different resources of people, like, advocating for homeless rights, like homeless people, never, ever making it way into this policy.
Early on, when the city realized this pandemic was going to last for a minute and it was unsafe for people to be out and about, it took a while, but, the city realized, oh, there's all these empty hotel rooms, but there's also all these empty conference centers. So Moscone Center, which is one of our largest kind of venues for tech conferences, industry conferences for the hotel industry, for example. They tried to create a temporary shelter, which was basically split up into 6 square feet. We'll put a picture in the show notes. So it's 6 square feet squares with a little cot, but not actually socially distanced in the way that people at that point already knew. This is going to be unsafe. Local governments love to call upon the specter of austerity to excuse themselves from helping people in any way. And so
at the start of the pandemic, the city leased nearly 1,000 hotel rooms for frontline workers, but officials now say they overestimated the need. 80% of the rooms regularly sat empty for the past several weeks, according to the San Francisco Chronicle.
It's pretty shocking, particularly when we were told that one of the reasons why we couldn't get more people into rooms is because it cost too much money.
On Twitter, Mayor London Breed said, "We need to be flexible when circumstances change." Supervisor Matt Haney says many first responders told him they didn't know such rooms were available to them. Today, for example, there were 751 unoccupied rooms, 445 of which the city pays for based on its contract. That equates to more than $30,000 in one day, according to numbers from the Human Services Agency obtained by the Chronicle. No one was coming to San Francisco to stay in a
hotel as a tourist. These rooms were completely empty. The city wanted to help the hotel owners out and said it wanted to help homeless people out, but it was renting these rooms at the prices of like pre-pandemic prices, basically. Meanwhile, the mayor is outside of San Francisco being hailed as this COVID hero, even though other recent events, such as her group dinner at the French Laundry in Napa Valley the day before our governor, former mayor of San Francisco, Gavin Newsom, was celebrating a birthday at the French Laundry. You know, her Twitter avatar, she's wearing what looks like a Photoshopped mask.
Yeah, there's been this movement to occupy empty buildings and take them over, including Moms for Housing in Oakland. That folks, yeah, did some like support, like going to, like they managed to have a lot of people coming out to support, to like stand in front of the house and to try to be a presence there when the police tried to evict the house.
Yeah. Since the beginning of COVID, the United States Postal Service has recorded 90,000 address changes, as in people moving out of San Francisco. And so what does that mean? That means that, yes, perhaps a good portion of that 90,000 have been purchased by other people, moved into by other people, but there is simply no way that 90,000 homes have actually been filled, and yet we still have a lot of people with no place to stay. And they're not allowing people into the shelter-in-place hotels at the moment. And there's been a fight, which we will get into, about keeping people in the hotels in the face of a city government who is highly anti-homeless, including the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing, which Let's see. City estimates that it costs about $15 to $18 million a month to keep these hotels a running. You know, they could have probably negotiated much better deals with these empty hotels. And so initially, December 21st, so, you know, the week of Christmas, which is historically when government entities, not just in San Francisco, love to, you know, make things happen undercover because people aren't paying as much attention. During a hearing in September, a bit of the plan to push people out of shelter-in-place hotels in the midst of Hanukkah, Christmas, Kwanzaa, etc., was laid bare during a hearing with the director of the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing, Abigail Stewart-Kahn. And we'll let Abigail kind of explain why she feels we need to get people out of the hotels as soon as humanly possible.
I don't want anybody to exit to the streets as much as everybody speaking tonight. And so that is the city's commitment, is to rehouse these individuals. My communication conundrum here is that when people were waiting in hotels with no closure dates against them, there was not a lot of motivation for our guests in our hotels to start to take steps to end their homelessness. And I, you know, and it's hard to move on. Change is really difficult for all of us. And when I talk to people in hotels, that's what I hear. And so as a clinical social worker, I think about that. You know, what is changing for people? What I think we learned is that in creating a sense of urgency, people are understanding now, as anxiety producing it as it is. And when I talk to people, I can tell you, you know, I understand that they are in tears.
I mean, yeah, I think I can speak to that. Gay Shame wants everyone to have the, you know, and believes that everyone has the right to like a safe place to stay and so much more, you know.
Except for techies.
Huh? Except for techies. yeah, but like always hoping to center the needs of people who are in this like most vulnerable and precarious situation in this real estate crisis that is, you know, kind of treated as though it's inevitable, but is in fact the construction of these like, you know, real estate interests, money, you know, like billionaires. And so you've got this, you know, city full of these like glamorous empty condos and then rich people complaining about all the people who are living on the street. And then complaining when people are relocated to hotels because it's tax dollars, supposedly. I guess it's not tax dollars though, right?
It's money that, you know, is in these pots, like FEMA money, state money for emergency situations like unforeseen events like the COVID-19 virus.
Right. And so we're trying to like basically hold this complexity of like this hostile environment for homeless people. And then we're trying to dive into a complex conversation about like what it can actually look like inside a shelter in place hotel and what kind of resources are actually available to people, what it looks like and what cost it comes at. So we have a special guest today, Mary Crisis, who we'll be interviewing further to give us information about their experience working in a shelter-in-place hotel.
Hello, hello. I'm Mary Crisis. If it's cool, I'll jump in a little bit about myself. So I currently work as a site monitor for one of the city's shelter-in-place hotels in the Tenderloin. My floor specifically shelters survivors of violence, including but not limited to trans, non-binary, and gender non-conforming people and people experiencing substance use, as well as detox and or houselessness. And my site has been in operation since mid-September, and it's run by a residential nonprofit. And that nonprofit basically deals with the logistics of the hotel itself and runs the show and is provided funding and supplies by the city, and that's kind of like how we all get paid. And this is the first time I've ever worked in a nonprofit, and most of my positions before this were in some kind of like admin reception gig. So this is kind of like my first time firsthand in direct service.
Like, what does that look like on a daily basis?
So basically you have two care coordinators that are below my floors that are responsible for the care, the permanent housing, allocating medical and behavioral resources to upwards of 40 people. And then you have our floor, which is one care coordinator, which we like lost a care coordinator and we were without one for like a month and a half before we got a new one. And that person is in charge of like 20 people allocating those resources.
When you talk about resources, like I know that that includes like resources and connections, but also just like around basic supplies, do you have adequate supplies for the people there?
In short, no. So our supplies, like it's so sad. Like we don't have like underwear up to a certain size. You know, we don't have socks. In the first couple of weeks, there was no PPE for PPE available for staff. And in October, I received an email from my site manager and the director of operations at the nonprofit that the city was out of toilet paper for the shelter-in-place hotels. And this resulted in obtaining toilet paper from the hotel's supplier directly, which is a completely separate thing from the city, and also obtaining toilet paper through supply and monetary donation. Anything that's not provided by the city is considered a gift. And we cannot accept gifts and we cannot give them because it looks like favoritism. But like one of the most jarring things that happened surrounding the lack of basic needs and supplies, one of the tenants had like asked for toilet paper and there was none. We had none to give, none on the floor, none in the entire hotel. We were completely out. And my shift lead had basically told the tenant, hey, like, I know that like we don't have toilet paper right now, but I also like I've noticed that like other tenants have taken it upon themselves to buy toilet paper, you know, with the money that they do have. And like telling this tenant, like, you know, these people are understanding that we aren't able to provide those basic needs. So like maybe you can just like go buy a roll until we get some more. And like she didn't even realize what the fuck she was saying. She didn't realize the volume, the just like I when I heard that, I was just like a ball of fire, you know? And one of like the first like gnarly red flags that I noticed was that in the entire hotel, there were no menstrual products available on site for any of the tenants. Like you called around, nobody had anything. The DPH nurses didn't have anything. And that really set me off because, I mean, I've known for a while that like menstrual products, like they're obviously like not only expensive, but really, really hard to come by for people experiencing houselessness, you know?
And also just to be clear, I think it might get lost, but that you've been actually fundraising for some of those basic supplies, like the menstrual supplies and snacks.
Yeah. Thankfully with help, there's no way in hell I'd be able to do it alone. It's like there's a stock room, there's supplies, there's Swiffers and some stuff. But when it comes to what these people like really need, it doesn't really get met unless, you know, people interfere with mutual aid and things like that.
Right. Well, and it's just so like completely against the like the culture of so many marginalized people, like surviving is like giving each other gifts, swapping stuff.
Exactly.
Like, stuff. Is it's like the policy seems designed against the actual culture of people who are going to be accessing the services.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree. There was a lot of drama on my site specifically where people like site monitors were refusing to heat up food. And a lot of people tried to blame that on COVID-19 protocol, things like that. And now it's in the rules, right, where you can't heat someone's food up if they give it to you. But if you're giving them meals, you can heat it up. But if, as soon as they touch that, they can't give it back. And it just blows my fucking mind.
Yeah, it's really weird how callous and burnt out people will get when they're put, like, I don't know. You could explain that kind of behavior so many ways, but, like, ultimately it's just really ungenerous to be like, you want your food heated and I'm not going to do it. Like, and I'm going to rely on these COVID protocols to excuse myself from doing it. It mm-hmm. just, like, tells you so much about those dynamics that can form in these kind of nonprofit settings. I just want to, like, reiterate that we, like, we want so much more, you know? Like, we want
people absolutely. To have
money. Like, a lot of times people just need money to be able to spend however, like, on whatever they need. You know, we want people to be able to have housing that's not monitored this way, that's free. We want these empty condos to be, like, redistributed to homeless people.
So, with the mutual aid thing, you know, it was just getting to the point where we would run out of shit and we would ask and ask and ask, and it would just be too long that we were asking, where's the supplies? Where it just got to the point, like, I was able to connect with a couple of other people who I will not mention to try and get the word out about collecting monetary and supply donations for things like menstrual products, toilet paper, snacks, protection, things like that. And, you know, with that, you know, I believe we've been able to pull in, I think, close to like 500 in supplies and donations, which is absolutely wonderful, but so frustrating to think that, you know, this has to come from, you know, like, housing advocates, like, completely outside of this, completely outside of the city and county, completely outside of these nonprofits. And, you know, the thing is like, if it was found out that I was doing mutual aid for my job, I would lose my job.
And meanwhile, I mean, the city has 200 million plus from state aid and FEMA, and also the toilet paper that they procured from the hotel. I'm just going to guess that the hotel, the Travelodge or Motel 6 or whatever chains they're contracting with, put a little premium on that toilet paper. Things that the city could easily negotiate because they hold the power.
Totally.
At the same time, with some of the state aid letting it run out because there's like, they put these deadlines on, you have to spend this much money by this time.
I guess like my point is like, you know, there needs to be more. There needs, like, there's all this shit about how the hotels are too expensive, how this plan is too expensive. This is one of the richest cities in the fucking country. And, you know, the number of people displaced is to the fault of, you know, the rich people here. And it's important that we, you know, make it clear, like, we're absolutely not on their side. People need to be housed. People need to be housed safely, and it needs to be accessible, and not through these, you know, people shouldn't have to, like, jump through all of these, like, city and county hoops to obtain like subpar sheltering, you know? And it's just a huge fucking joke. It's a huge fucking joke.
Yeah, and it's coming up on the end of the month. So, you know, we're gonna see all these U-Hauls of the, you know, upper middle class and the millionaires from tech companies moving out as they have been during the pandemic for, you know, more space. Into the suburbs and going off to gentrify other cities. We got a lot of housing.
Yeah, and it just, like, it tells you so much that, like, there are all these conditional provisions around the support that's provided through the shelter-in-place hotels, where it's, like, you have to meet all of these criteria, you have to eat this food, et cetera, when it's, like, I think it becomes unthinkable to people that, like, homeless people could be housed in condos or in, like, luxury real estate, because there's this whole, like, construct of, like, what people deserve that is, like, operating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree with that. So to dive a bit deeper into the surveillance aspect that goes into the operation of these hotels, wellness checks are to be completed every single day. At my site, each tenant needs a completed wellness check per day. And in addition to those wellness checks, we dedicate one day a week for thorough room checks to ensure that the state of the room lives up to the standards in the contract each tenant signed. And at other sites, I've heard that those checks can be even more frequent. I've heard anywhere upwards from 3 to 4 times a day per person, per tenant.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot to take in, just like imagining like just the level, like the lack of privacy and the lack of like feeling like a space is really your own when someone can come in and check it, like what you're talking about, like sometimes multiple times a day. It's just got my brain thinking about all the barriers to people feeling like safe and secure with their belongings, like having to check the key before leaving. Also just strikes me as something that would be a real barrier.
When I was initially hired by my nonprofit, I was told that in any crisis, calling the police would be a last resort. And as of lately, there's been an increase in crises at the hotel, and some ending very violently. And when there is a lack in these trauma-informed and non-judgmental approaches, there's often reluctance to want to open up about your hardships with staff. And honestly, like, right? Like, how can you blame them? Why would you want to open up to somebody about, like, what you're going through or what you have gone through with a member of staff who treats you like a number, who misgenders you, or who uses awful terms like crackhead, drug addict, tweaker? Like, all of that is like shit that you hear while you're on the clock.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of what's at the heart of like having a trauma-informed approach is like also having that it gets disrupted by having so much hierarchy or surveillance happening within a setting. Like if it's the same person who's checking your room to make sure like there's no damage to the hotel that you would also be seeking as a service or like reaching out to for help. Like it seems like the structure of it creates like bad faith or can create bad faith.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I can't really blame anybody for that. Like it's really unsettling because like, you know, like when I was hired on, we were told like language is important. When I'm at work, I refer to a lot of the tenants as guests, and I don't know why it took me a while, but, you know, like they're not guests. A lot of them are, you know, fleeing, trying to, you know, get clean or, you know, like have all of these, because they've been promised, right? They've been promised that in coming here that they're going to receive permanent housing at the end of whatever, you know, however fucking long this thing's going to last. And like when I was hired, like I was told that this hotel would be in operation for 1 to 2 years. And that's been dramatically cut back.
Right. Yeah. It sounds like there was like this promise of permanent housing. Do you have an idea of how many people have been approved to receive like permanent housing through coordinated entry?
So I know that none of the tenants on my floor have been approved to receive permanent housing through coordinated entry. So speaking to what I know about coordinated entry, around the time there were a lot of rumors going around that the shelter in place hotels in the city were going to close before Christmas, and the city and county made a point to send kind of like a letter. It's really pathetic thing from the COVID-19 command center outlining in extremely vague verbiage the next steps tenants should take for housing placement. And basically, it is up to the tenants at the shelter-in-place hotel to call the hotline to take an approximately 30-minute quantitative housing priority assessment that reviews the tenant's lived experiences, their current housing and financial situation. And if that tenant doesn't pass this housing assessment, they are told to call again and to retake that assessment in 6 months. And the person on the other end of the hotline is not a person formally trained in taking a trauma-informed approach or in any sort of case management or social work. And depending on who is on the other end of that line, they may or may not speak another language in addition to English either. When about 3/4 of the city's shelter-in-place hotel residents are minorities, close to half of them being Black and a quarter Latinx or Asian.
It's like, I don't know, anyone who's had experience calling to try to connect with those kind of resources know that there are so many myriad like barriers to accessing services and actually getting linked up with supportive housing. It sounds really disheartening to get that letter.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. I came in one day and I saw like a stack of flyers and, you know, my monitor was just like, or the one that was the monitor relieving me was just like, oh, you need to like put these on everyone's door. And I looked at it. I was like, are you kidding me? Like this is because like the rumors were going around hot about the possibility of our hotel closing before Christmas. Everybody was asking me about it. And, you know, I was trying to be as transparent as possible. Granted, I didn't know a date. I still technically don't know a date on when the hotel will close.
Right. And even just like getting a message by having it posted on your door, like so often, I mean, that's how our landlord communicates with us. And it every time you see a piece of paper on your door when you come home, it's always going to feel like this is me getting kicked out, you know?
Exactly. It's anxiety inducing because you see it and you're like, this is it, you know?
Can I also ask something about, you know, Merry Crisis, we were talking about 2020 and what's been happening to labor this year in general, like affective labor, like sort of essential labor and, you know, unessential labor, like labor that is like traditionally deprioritized, devalued. And so it's interesting, it's that... what's happening with these hotels is like an institutional devaluation of labor or a kind of passing the buck.
And absolutely.
People feeling like, well, these shelter in place hotels, maybe they'll be able to do X, Y, Z. And how this is kind of like endless deferral of that happening. Of course, this has been going on for a long time, as I said, but 2020 seems like a particularly precarious and horrifying culmination of just this kind of people falling through the cracks and a kind of expectation that someone will rise to the occasion to perform this sort of
right
kind of magically. So it's like we want to talk about what happens in these hotels and we don't want to, you know, devalue what people are doing there, but also recognizing that like what we're witnessing is the state is sort of unilaterally deciding that people who do these kind of really essential, like important things, like provide mental health support, provide a crisis. I forget the term you were using.
Like crisis management?
Yeah. What we're witnessing is how your labor is like not valued at all by the state or institutions. What do you think needs to change?
It's hard to like pinpoint it on like a couple of things because if you're not being supported, whether that's like city and county not supporting the big bosses not supporting the staff's not going to give a shit, you know, the staff's going to like come collect that paycheck and they're going to go home. And at the end of the day, like whether or not these tenants housed is not their problem, whether or not, you know, the city is failing to meet basic needs and supplies. You know, I'm going to be honest, a lot of us serve as a therapist on the daily. Like, we don't have counselors. We don't have like people trained in case management on site, you know, and when you have people that aren't properly trained to de-escalate situations, you have upper management saying, okay, well, if you can't handle it, this is when you involve security. This is when you involve the police. And it just makes no sense, you know, especially like with my force specifically, how you have like a lot of the people there being a survivor of violence. You know, I know in my head, like literally the last thing I want to do is involve a security guard. The last thing I want to do is involve police.
Yeah, it just like, I really appreciate Mary Prance's questions for like drawing out like the affective labor that is put on people in your position to like knowing that the stakes are that security or police could be called to try to ameliorate situations or help people avoid that kind of crisis, but without like in the absence of that training. It just reminds me a lot about episode 3, the conservatorship episode. We just like with this kind of like swift path with a denial of service to then being houseless and vulnerable, then to police like 5150s, which is like the police code in California for like mental health wellness checks that are the police coming and locking up people that, you know, again, in the context of this city that is, you know, hates homeless people and hates mental health on the street. That so much of the stakes of that denial of service would be knowing that someone might end up in conservatorship or end up in jail. It just sounds like a lot of pressure on people who do care about the people who are tenants there to try to avoid those situations. But in this situation, it seems like you're really set up to be calling the security and calling the cops.
Yeah, that's how I feel about it. You know, I can't remember the word, but it's like when you get trauma from being around trauma so much.
Right.
Right. And these nonprofits want to take on more than they can handle when it comes to direct service. And a lot of it is so that they can, you know, get that money, that recognition from the city and county. And you got to think, like, none of these people in these upper management positions, like, they're not here every day. They're not, they don't know the tenants personally. They don't know what happened with their past. They don't know what brought them here. And it's so easy for people with that kind of power to literally just like wipe their hands clean of the problems that they are literally creating. So it's so sad because like you just find shit out, you know? You find out they bought a new house. You find out they bought a new car. You find out that they're going to hire a new director with full ass salary and shit. And this hotel, this shelter in place hotel that's housing, you know, what, like almost 100 people or something like that, is being run into the ground. There's no answers. All of the resources that we have are resources that members of our staff who have lived experiences themselves, those are the resources that they're getting them from. They're not from the city. They're from lived experiences, prior experiences that they've had, places that they themselves have gone to try and get them out of certain situations.
So 60 days is what the Board of Supervisors approved, an extension of the hotels staying open as of December 16th, which I guess can be repeated after those 60 days are up mid-February. But we'll see where we're at that point. I mean, especially given, you know, the vaccine distribution, we don't know how that's going to happen. Honestly, everyone inside of jails, as has been called for, jails and prisons, nursing homes, and encampments, SIP hotels, those are the people that should be getting at first. A lot of those people are at risk more than anywhere else.
There's been no update from city and county or DPH about vaccine distribution to staff at the shelter-in-place hotels or any of the shelter-in-place hotel residents. It's it is my understanding that if anybody's going to be getting it first, it's going to be the nurses and it's going to be the doctors. And they're all, you know, a part of DPH and stuff. It's understandable, absolutely. But considering the fact that, you know, let's say a tenant is experiencing symptoms of COVID. If they are experiencing symptoms on one of the days where the DPH nurses do not come to the site, which they only come to the site 2 days a week, then we have to essentially call an ambulance, get them to the hospital where they can have a COVID test. And if there was on-site COVID testing for these shelter-in-place hotels, it would make sense to me that, you know, there was some sort of vaccine priority as well. And I'm just not seeing either of those things.
All I know is London Breed has all the toilet paper and the vaccine.
I believe it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's all, I mean, like, this is my first time, but it's always a pleasure.
We'll be hearing more from Mary Crisis in the near future. For now, I am Mary Howard Johnson signing off.
Mary Daggers signing off.
And Mary Prance signing off.
I just want to be careful with language. We will continue to rely on data and facts that we're collecting, create some kind of special sauce that creates that sense of urgency. And when I talk to people, I can tell you, you know, I understand that they are in tears.
And when I talk to people, I can tell you, you know, I understand that they are in tears. I understand that they are in tears.